Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere comes from MX Publishing, the largest catalog of new Sherlock Holmes books in the world. New novels, biographies, graphic novels, and short story collections about Sherlock Holmes. Find them online at mxpublishing.com.
And by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
And Dan Andreacco Mysteries, featuring Sebastian McCabe and Jeff Cody. Their new second casebook, Murderer's Row, is here, featuring stories around the holidays. More information at danandreacco.com. I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 200, Enola Holmes.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Welcome back to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Bert Wolder.
And boy, are we excited today because we are going to be talking with the author of the Enola Holmes mystery series, which of course has been turned into a movie on Netflix, scheduled to come out on September 23rd. We'll be with Nancy Springer in just a moment. But first, we want to remind you that you can find the show notes for this episode at ihose.co/ihose200. And that will bring you directly to our website, which is ihearofsherlock.com. There on that notes page, you can leave us a comment. You can find links to the stories and books and other things that we're talking about in this episode. And you can share it with other people. We love other people to learn about our show, and you are our best way of getting the word out. So if you're enjoying what you hear here, if you are enjoying what you read on our site, please consider sharing it on whatever platform works for you. We do appreciate your support, and we look forward to getting the word out. Well, Bert, I mentioned that the secret link for this show episode is ihose.co/ihose200. It's our 200th episode.
Oh, we don't look an episode over 150.
And I'm sorry, I didn't get you anything for our 200th. What, do you know what the traditional anniversary gift is for 200?
Well, I think it's... Yeah, I think it must be a burial plot.
Plot. Well, I was thinking along the Walt Disney lines. I was thinking liquid nitrogen.
Oh, liquid nitrogen. Oh, yeah, very good. Cryogenics.
Everyone.
It's the cryogenic anniversary.
Amazing. Well, yeah, we have been on the air now for 14 seasons, and this is our 200th episode. We managed to crank out, what is it, about... 24 episodes a year. So we're on a pretty steady pace at this point. Not as often as some people would like, and too frequent as other people say. So, you know, I think we're striking a good balance at this point.
Oh, me too. And we've got lots of interesting things to talk about and think about in the months ahead. So there's no end in sight.
And if you are a new listener, if you're just joining us because you enjoy the Enola Holmes stories and you enjoy Nancy Springer, welcome. We encourage you to listen to our back catalog, which, you know, we're available on most major podcast platforms. But you can also go to our website and look under the listen section there in the navigation and find our show archives there. Which, if you'd like the handy abbreviated URL for that. It's ihose.co/ihoseshows, all lowercase. We'll have that as a link in the show notes as well. So feel free to look through our back catalog and see what interests you. We now are a primarily interview show, but we have earlier episodes where we talked about Sherlockian topics. And if it's other Sherlockian topics that interest you, we also have a companion program that comes out every week. It's about 15 to 20 minutes long, and it's called Trifles. You can find that at SherlockHolmesPodcast.com. So feel free to listen to your heart's content. Nancy Springer has published 40 novels for adults, young adults, and children, in a career beginning shortly after she graduated from Gettysburg College in 1970. Springer wrote for 10 years in the imaginary realms of mythological fantasy, then ventured on to contemporary fantasy, magical realism, and women's fiction and suspense before turning her attention to children's literature. Her novels and stories for middle grade and young adults range from contemporary realism, mystery, crime, and fantasy to her critically acclaimed novels based on the Arthurian mythos I Am Mordred, A Tale of Camelot, and I Am Morgan Le Fay. Springer's children books have won her 2 Edgar Allan Poe Awards, a Carolyn W. Field Award, various Children's Choice Honors, and numerous ALA Best Book listings. Her most recent series include The Tales of Rowan Hood, featuring Robin Hood's daughter, and the Enola Holmes Mysteries, starring the much younger sister of Sherlock Holmes. Nancy Springer, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you.
Well, we will start with you, where we put the spotlight on all of our guests and ask you where it is that you first met Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, when I was very young, my mother had a tremendous library of books, which I, to this day, do not understand, because there were no bookstores back in the 1950s where she got all those books. But she had the complete set of Conan Doyle, and I had read and reread and reread until I had memorized every Sherlock Holmes story and novel by the time I was 10 or 12, and I was very upset that I had no more. They were all gone.
Were you able to do anything to cure that ennui?
I think I went on to other things like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, but there's nothing like a good Sherlock Holmes story.
Hmm. So it sounds like you grew up in a household full of readers.
Yes, I did. Both my parents were readers. I have 2 much older brothers, just like Enola. I have 2 much, much older brothers. And reading was pretty much what we all did. One of the household rules was that one was not allowed to bring books to the dinner table.
Yeah, Philistine.
Right. Because if you didn't have that rule, everybody would be sitting there looking at a book. Yeah.
Reading instead of conversing. You got it.
Yeah. And so what was your favorite kind of fiction? I know that, you know, you mentioned Tolkien, and I know your first book, and you've written, I think, probably more than 40 books at this point, but your first book was sort of a Tolkien-like adventure, fantasy adventure, wasn't it?
Yeah, high fantasy, mythic fantasy. Yeah, that my reading tastes are very eclectic, though. I was an English lit major in college, and before that, I would simply read anything I got my hands on, including the back of the cereal box. There were not enough books. I was a person who was always looking for something to read.
What did you think you were going? Did you think you were going to teach, or did you always think? What was your first story? What was the first story you ever wrote?
The first story. Well, I remember trying to write something when I was in high school and giving it up in disgust. But the first thing I wrote actually was my first published book.
Oh, and was that Wings of Flame? Is that what that was?
No, that was, it was called The Book of Suns, but it later was retitled The Silver Sun.
Ah.
Yeah. And as for what I thought I was going to be, I had no clue. This was back before women had such thoughts. I lived in a very old-fashioned family. My mother was 40 when I was born, and she was born in 1906. My father was born, no, other way around. My father was born in 1906. My mother was born in 1909. So they were old-fashioned farmhouse-type people. And everybody just assumed I was going to be a teacher, but I didn't. I didn't want to be a teacher. I'd had enough of school.
And where in the world was this? Was this East Coast, West Coast, Midwest?
I was born in New Jersey, Livingston, New Jersey, on the last piece of farmland probably left in that area. And when I was 13, my parents moved to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. My dad and mom bought a little motel, and I helped them with motel keeping until I went to college, where I actually went to college in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, because my violin teacher got me a scholarship there.
Wow. But if your parents, my parents, were sort of similarly aged. My father, my late father was born in 1910 and my mother in 1915. And I imagine like my parents, your parents certainly noticed the depression as it rolled over them.
Oh my gosh. My mother always checked the waste cans in the motel in case anybody had left anything of value. I mean, had thrown out something that they didn't want, but she did.
So when did you discover that writing could be more than just a happy pastime, that it could actually be a living?
I don't think writing was ever exactly a happy pastime with me. I kept notebooks. I kept lists of vocabulary words, and I did book reports in the summertime on my own when I was out of school. But I wasn't – I enjoyed writing, but I enjoyed drawing. I enjoyed music. I enjoyed many things. What happened, I guess, is that the daydreams, when I was 15 – I started to have the most vivid, almost compulsive, rather scary daydreams. And that continued on into my adulthood. And eventually I simply decided that since I couldn't afford a psychiatrist, I was going to have to offload them somehow, and I would try writing.
That's great. That's great. So you actually you took your daydreams as inspirations and turned those into your books?
Yeah. That was the way the fantasy novels happened.
Wow. Is this a common occurrence among fantasy writers?
I don't know. I don't have anybody to ask. I expect so. Yeah, we do seem to be much of a oneness, fantasy writers.
Mm. Is that how you think of yourself, as primarily a fantasy writer?
Well, evidently I'm not anymore. But I've done a 180 degree turn in my life. When I was a child and when I was a young adult and during my first marriage, I was extremely, extremely repressed emotionally, which is why I had the daydreams. And then I went through a long, nasty period of clinical depression because all those emotions refused to be repressed anymore, but I thought they were evil, bad, and terrible, and I was ashamed of myself. And after that, I eventually started writing fiction where my eyes looked outward instead of inward. See, the fantasy was me, my psyche, in form of princes in armor and so forth on the landscape was me, my innermost self. But after a while, as I started to get over it, I turned more to contemporary fiction and magical realism, contemporary fantasy. And I was writing, I gave myself an assignment to write a book for kids who don't like to read. That's crazy, you know. Let's grow cattle for vegetarians. Let's make guns for pacifists. But that book turned out to win an Edgar Allan Poe Award, and I had no idea that I wrote mystery.
Ooh, which book was that?
It was called Toughing It. And then I won another Edgar the next year for a different book. And I still had no idea I wrote mystery. My agent informed me that I did, absolutely. So I started selling short stories to Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queens.
It's wonderful. I mean, it sounds, you know, so many, well, everyone is different. You know, there are writers who have, think of themselves naturally as genre writers. There are writers who have genres imposed on them. You know, you sound like a passionate writer whose interests and expressions occasionally intersect with the market. And then you find out, oh, okay, well, if that's what you want to call it, I can do more of that. You know.
I think once I decided I was a writer, which it took me like five books before I really realized I was a writer and not just a housewife who wrote books. And before I started saying, I am going to write first thing in the morning instead of making breakfast for everybody. But anyhow, after the fifth book, I decided I really was a writer. And somewhere in that process, I decided that a real writer wrote whatever, everything, anything. Hmm. So I branched out in all directions, if only for financial reasons, because at one point I was supporting my family, and then at that point I wrote a fantasy novel and a children's novel every year.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sounds a lot like people like J.K. Rowling. You know, they have much in common with you. But I was intrigued in what you just said about writing before breakfast. You know, and many people who are – well, many writers – you have to be careful when you ask them what their process is. But I'm just curious, what was your process? Did you have to sort of stake out this time and say, okay, here's the deal. I'm doing 2,000 words a day, and I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. before anybody else gets up?
Oh, no, I never had a word count a day, and I never in my life got up at 4 a.m., at least unless I had an airplane to catch. But I did say to my family, look, I'm going to write first thing in the morning, and that was that. The process, when I was writing fantasy, when I was starting, the process was that I would go to bed and ask my, whatever you want to call it, the night shift, the elves, you know, the part of me that was going to be dreaming, ask me what was next in the book. And then I would daydream, and then I would go to sleep, and then in the morning I would wake up knowing what I was going to write.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, that's a lot like John Milton. You know, Milton, who was, of course, did his greatest work after he'd lost his sight, but he felt that when he slept, he got all these ideas, and the first thing in the morning he just needed someone to write it down. You know, he would just talk to someone and say, okay, take this down.
Yeah. I pity his daughters, but yes.
That's fascinating. That really is fascinating. I know, looking at your, you know, at your enormous output of books over the years, you've it seems as if you've spent time chronologically in series. So, and I know that on the fantasy side, you've had this series of books that started with what's called the Book of the Isle, with, you know, the White Heart and the Book of Suns and the Sable Moon, and then the Sea King and so on. How did all that happen? You know, did you more or less
accidentally? I started by writing what I called the Book of Suns, which eventually became the Silver Sun. And then I wrote a sequel to it, and then I wrote a prequel to it. And by that time, I still hadn't sold any of that stuff. And it was eventually organized and edited and greatly assisted by the people at Pocket Books. And then I realized, okay, I seem to be writing a series, so I wrote a couple more books that kind of sort of fitted in. And after, like, the first 10 years, they came to be called the Books of Isle. I never gave them that title or you know, I was just writing one book at a time, and they hooked into each other. Partly because the first book I ever wrote was, like, five times too long, so I had to take it apart, and I used all the leftovers for the next several books.
Hmm. And in your writing, what about the role of women? I know that in a series you did around Rowan Hood, you know, this was the outlaw girl of Sherwood Forest. Have you always been driven to powerful, you know, women protagonists in your fiction?
Well, honestly, the first 10 books or 15 books, the fantasy books, I was a guy. I didn't even know I was a woman. I mean, my imaginary self was a prince. And after a while, I started to realize I was female, and I wrote things like The Hex, Which Is Seldom. Actually, the very first book that I wrote where I started to realize, hey, female, was Wings of Flame. And that has a very much tormented and martyred female personage in there. That was my self-image as a child and as a young woman, was your basic martyr. So in terms of having any sort of power or agency, I imagined myself into male characters. Then somehow or other, during the course of all that mayhem that went on within me, all of the depression and all the rest of it, I became what I am now. I probably wouldn't recognize me if I met me before.
Now,
what was your path to back to mysteries? You know, so I know that the first Enola Holmes story was sort of around 2004 or something like that, wasn't it? And wasn't that your sort of return to mystery?
Okay, hereby lieth a tale. Years ago, probably back sometime in the 1970s, no, the 1980s, I was living in Windber, Pennsylvania. Okay. I looked at the checkbook, and it was not looking good. So I called Jane Yolen. I had had a letter from her saying she was doing an anthology on King Arthur. And I wanted to know if she still needed a story. She said technically it was closed, but she had not had a Mordred story. So I said, I can do that. And I went and walked the dog. And by the time I got back, I had the germ of a Mordred story, and I completed it quickly. And I thought that was that. But the editor in-house, the editor in Philomel, fell in love with that story, and he wanted a book out of it, which became I Am Mordred. And for the next several years, I worked very closely with him. He was a brilliant editor. His name was Michael Green. And he said, why don't you write Morgan Le Fay? And I did. And then I said, why don't I write Rowan Hood? It was Jane Yolen again. She was doing a Sherwood anthology. And I said, well, why don't I write Rowan Hood? That was my idea. But then he called me and said, I want you to write something set in deepest, darkest London at the time of Jack the Ripper.
Oh.
And he was an extremely savvy editor, and I had never written anything historical in my life. So I said to myself, I had to take him seriously because he was, you know, he was the man. So I said to myself, I always read my mom's King Arthur books, and I wrote the Camelot stories. I always read my mom's Robin Hood books, and I wrote the Rowan Hood stuff. What did my mom have when I was a kid? What did I read that was set in deepest, darkest London at the time of Jack the Ripper? Sherlock Holmes.
Perfect. Well, this is a perfect place for us to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. And after that, we will come back and talk with Nancy Springer about more of Enola Holmes. Stay tuned. Well, our friends at MX Publishing are always up to something, a lot of something, quite frankly. And here's one we wanted to bring to your attention. This is a book that has been out for a while, but there's a special hardback edition available coming up, well, right now. It is The Lighter Side of Sherlock Holmes. It's a collection of Sherlockian cartoons by Norman Chattel. And evidently, Mr. Chattel was big in the 1970s. He was a member of the BSI, this would have been the Julian Wolfe era, and did a number of illustrations that appeared in the Baker Street Journal and the Sherlock Holmes Journal, Serpentine Muse, and other places. Bert, I know you're into art in general, certainly more broadly, but did you ever know Norm Chattel in your time in the BSI?
Oh, I must have. But I remember his work, you know, Art in the Blood takes strangest forms. But I'm a big fan of illustration and cartooning. And cartoons are important because you know, they teach us so many things in our life. And Norm Chattel's work is great because here he's taking moments and scenes of the canon and just turning them into illustrations that work at a glance. He had a lovely, couple of lovely things about Norm Chattel's work. One is the line. You know, one of the great cartoonists, illustrators, who was called, in fact, the Line King, was Al Hirschfeld, theatrical illustrator. But Norm's work is similarly all line and with a great use of wash. And he's found lovely little moments in this cartoon collection where Holmes and Moriarty meet with Holmes as a young person, which is wonderful. Holmes at a haberdasher's saying to the attendant there, I'm starting a small consulting practice, and looking at the range of hats, one of which is a deerstalker. But Norm had a wonderful hand, a great eye for setting up a scene. And it's wonderful to see these things again. And the lovely thing is they spark jokes in your mind. And they spark smiles. But they also help people understand the magic of Sherlock Holmes and look a little bit beneath some of the tropes and stereotypes. So it's lovely to see Norm Chattel's work again.
It is, and it's something his son Glenn is eminently and rightly proud of. And you can get a copy of that book if you go to mxpublishing.com and check out The Lighter Side of Sherlock Holmes. We are back, and we are here for what everyone is here for, and that is to talk about the connection with Sherlock Holmes. Nancy, you left us on a cliffhanger there, remembering those books that you couldn't get enough of from your mother's bookshelves and the inspiration for Enola Holmes. I think we've seen that, you know, where this is all going. You know, you discovered the powerful female persona within yourself. You linked it up with the deepest, darkest London of the time of Jack the Ripper. Set us on a path for how Enola Holmes sprung to life.
Well, my first thought, of course, was to give Sherlock Holmes a daughter. Then I realized this was simply impossible. Sherlock Holmes, I don't think ever... I think he's still a virgin. I don't know. I just can't go there with Sherlock Holmes. So then it occurred to me to give him a much, much younger sister. And of course, having been an avid reader of Sherlock Holmes, I had long since noticed that his attitude towards women was cool at best. There was Irene Adler, of course, but then again, there were all the other women who, were pretty much fluffer nutter, just little dingbats in the cases. So I thought he deserved to have a younger sister who was as smart as him, but in a feminine way. And what people don't realize about being a woman in Victorian times was that women were basically conspirators in holding their own against the power of men. Women had languages, secret languages and codes. And they had to help each other and befriend each other in order to get by in the world of Victorian society. So it's also a mother-daughter story, because Enola's mother was a suffragist. And that was why Enola never saw her brothers, because they couldn't get along with her mother.
Interesting. Now, what's the age gap between the brothers and Enola?
Oh, I did the math once. I think it's something like 10 to 14 years.
Okay. So Enola, in many ways, is growing up as an only child.
Exactly, which I did also.
You did? Okay, because you mentioned having brothers that were... about the same age difference there. So how does that come about? And, you know, just by way of full disclosure, both Bert and I are only children. So take us into the psychology or the kind of the unique scenarios that an only child will encounter and how that plays into the psyche of Enola Holmes.
Well, Enola Holmes, I didn't realize it until I was actually ready to hand the first book in. And I felt such butterflies as I had not felt for the last 30 or 40 years. And I hadn't realized how much of myself I had put into her. She really is almost an alter ego for me. I don't know if I'm answering your question satisfactorily, because maybe it's too close to home. I can't quite see it.
No, please keep going.
I was lonely. As a child, I was very much alone and lonely. And my mother was much like Enola's mother in the books. She was preoccupied, a good woman, and a very intelligent and very teacherly, but preoccupied. She was an artist, and she was an artist as her profession, which set me up to be a writer as for my profession. I never got into that thing of, am I allowed to be a writer? Of course I was. But let's see, what else can I tell you?
Well, you know, it's a little unfair because everybody's experience is different. But, you know, when you are an only child, you know, you don't have that interaction with siblings, particularly when, as you say, you know, you have a mother who's distracted and on other things. But it sounds from your description that you've always sort of taken your life and your dreams and just naturally expressed them on the page. And that's probably more intense when you're an only child rather than if you've got other children around who've got their own competing needs.
Well, I guess it would be fair to say that I had no, I kept everything inside until I finally started to write when I was an adult. I just, I was a bullied child. I was an unpopular, well-behaved, unplayful, entirely too serious school child, very much bullied. And, my mother did nothing about it. I told her once, and she was almost more upset than I almost made her cry. So it's like, okay, I have to be the adult here and let Mom alone to do her art.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Nancy, because I think there's an unspoken personality type that comes with being an only child. That, yes, the stereotype is that you get all your parents' attention. You could potentially be spoiled as a result. But at the same time, the thing that doesn't get spoken about is the enormous responsibility that comes with being an only child. Having to take on some of your own growth, certainly having to take care of your parents as they age, since there are no siblings to help with that. How does this play out into Enola Holmes's personality and the responsibilities she takes on?
Well, the situation is similar in that her mother puts her own needs before those of her daughter, and she simply leaves. In the books, when Enola is 14 years old, she simply decides, okay, it's time for me to go. I've had enough of this staying in one place and living according to society's rules. And she disappears. And my mother was an abandoning sort. I'm sure my brothers would not see her that way, or anybody who knew her, because she was a delightful person. But central theme of my childhood is the sense of having been abandoned and simply having to deal with everything by myself, because my parents were getting older and they were very concerned with their own financial difficulties, especially after they moved and got the motel. And I was just supposed to keep a stiff upper lip and keep my chin up and deal with whatever happened. When I was about 15, my mother was in the hospital for a protracted period of time, and nobody talked about it. I had no idea what was going on. Nobody said the word cancer. There was a strong British streak in there. My father was from Ireland, but he was a Southern Protestant Irishman named Henry, and all his siblings had very British monarchy-type names. So there was a very British sort of dynamic in the family where we didn't talk about things. The more important they were, the more we didn't mention them. So my mother had cancer when I was 15, and I didn't know it. I knew something was dreadfully wrong, but nobody was talking about it. And for a period of months there, I did the grocery shopping, and I cooked the meals. And eventually she came home again, and we still didn't talk about it.
Well, it's not surprising that in the first Enola Holmes story, you know, one of the central issue is the Enola's mother who disappears on her 14th birthday.
Exactly. I had a disappearing mother.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, she disappeared when I was about 14. You're quite right. Hey, you're smart.
Now, with your prodigious output, have you been involved in the past in work to dramatize and put your stories on the screen?
I've often had options taken, but they never went any further than options. So no, this is my first movie, and it's been an absolute joy.
What was the transition? You know, the big difference, of course, is that bringing something to the screen is such a collaborative art. And the lovely part about being a novelist is you are God. You know, if it's going to rain that day, you make it rain. And if the character's wearing red, they wear red. And if there's a car coming down the road, you put it there. How did it feel to turn these characters in this setting over to a larger team?
Well, it's true that you are God as a writer, but you do learn not to be selfish, because other people, once the book is published, other people are going to share it. I always think of writing as a two-headed process. The story starts in my head with my daydreams or whatever, and the art of writing is to make those little black words on the white paper, to choose them so that they will create the same or similar images in another person's head, in a reader that you've never met, a total stranger. I always, as a writer, reminded myself that the root word of imagination is image, and that it's all about pictures. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that I can write about, say, somebody blonde, and the reader, if they want to, they will turn them into a redhead. Or, you know, I can be writing about somebody of one skin color, and the reader, if they feel like it, will turn them into somebody of another skin color. And this is absolutely, it's more than okay. It's wonderful. It's kind of magical. It's sort of like telepathy, a coded kind of telepathy. So if I were, for instance, to try to write a picture book, I would have no input as to what the artist would do as the pictures. So that would be the reader responding in a similar way. The reader responds with his or her own interpretation of my books.
Mm.
So it wasn't a far step from having that philosophy of unselfishness to saying, hey, they're making a movie.
We'll be back to hear Nancy's reaction to her story come to life on the screen just after these words.
Sherlock Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle have been topics of conversation in the world of literature ever since 1895. Wouldn't it be great to look through all those discussions, have all those articles, reviews, and commentary in one place on your bookshelf? Now you can, because the Wessex Press has published Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, and The Bookman. All the pastiches, parodies, letters, all the columns and commentaries about Sherlock Holmes from 1895 to 1933, from the finest literary magazine of the 20th century, The Bookman, in one place, bringing back dozens of long-lost commentaries about the chronicles of Sherlock Holmes. Don't wait until this handsome volume is out of print. Get your copy of Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, and The Bookman right now at WessexPress.com. What does it feel like? I mean, we're recording this conversation several weeks before Enola Holmes debuts on Netflix on September 23rd, but presumably you've seen it. So what does it feel like to see the people you've imagined and written about and moved around up on a screen?
Actually, I haven't seen it. I was there for part of the filming, and I met Millie Bobby Brown and Henry Cavill and Fiona Shaw and Harry Bradbeer, the producer, and a lot of wonderful people. And I saw this tremendous effort of hundreds of people, crew members and all sorts of auxiliary members, trying to put together this movie, and the tremendous effort that Millie Bobby Brown and her sister Paige were putting into the producing of the movie, and got that same sense of being part of something that was bigger than I am. Once you've completed a book and you set it free, then it's on its own. it's bigger than the writer is. Okay, I'll go back. When I was in college, when I was an English lit major, the professors would talk often about something called the intentional fallacy. The book is not necessarily what the writer intended. A lot of things will get into books that the writer had no idea are there. And when people take it and make it into a movie or whatever, they may see those things and they may exploit them. And it's part of the process, and it is truly cool.
Now, what was your initial reaction to the casting choices? Was Millie Bobby Brown the Enola Holmes of your imagination? Did she kind of fit into the visualization or the personality that you had made for Enola?
Physically speaking, nobody has fit in. Like, for instance, they did the graphic novels, and Enola in the graphic novels does not look at all like the Enola who was in my imagination, but I love her just the same. Mm-hmm. She's still Enola. And Millie Bobby Brown, you know, it was her idea. It all started with her. This was not a thing where a Hollywood producer decided to make a movie. It was a thing where a girl read a book. Here I am. For years, I've been writing for teenagers and preteens, and one of them read my book and gave it to her younger sister. It was Paige Brown who gave it to Millie. And Millie said, I want to be this person. And she took it and spearheaded it. And it's all up to her. It's all due to her.
Wow.
So I could sit, you know, am I going to say you don't look like Enola? I don't think so.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And so are there more Enola Holmes books on the horizon? And will you think, if so, will you be thinking of Millie Bobby Brown as you move this character around?
No, I will be thinking of Enola.
Ah, good.
But yes, there are more books out there. But there have been actually for years, but my agent has been waiting. It's all a matter of timing.
Oh, good.
I asked her when she was going to start marketing the other books, and she said, oh, probably like September 24th.
Perfect timing.
Oh, good idea.
I love that. Now,
I know that P.D. James, you know, who had this great series with a character named Adam Dalgleish, you know, after
yes,
a while.
I know Adam. Love
yeah,
him.
She, yes, sure. But she began thinking of him as Roy Marsden, who I think played him for something like 15 years.
Yeah. No, well, I don't know if she did, but I haven't reached that point yet where I think of Sherlock as Henry Cavill or anything. They're still my own people. But I don't mind sharing them with everybody else. Everybody else is entitled to their vision as much as I'm entitled to mine.
Who did you think of when you were thinking of Sherlock, when you were writing her brother? Were you thinking of Basil Rathbone?
No, Jeremy Brett.
Ah.
Good answer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, though. I was initially taken aback at the selection of Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes. You don't typically put Superman and Sherlock Holmes together. If you're going to associate Sherlock Holmes with any superhero, traditionally it's Batman, right? Because let's face it, Sherlock Holmes was the original Caped Crusader. but when I saw the trailer in these past few weeks, and Henry Cavill stood there in that long double-breasted frock coat, he looked a lot like William Gillette, or certainly like Frederick Dorr Steele's illustrations of William Gillette in the early 1900s. And I thought, you know, this could actually work.
I was there when I was watching when Henry and Millie filmed a very emotional scene that takes place at the boarding school that she is trying. She's trying not to beg him to get her out of there. Sherlock is a little bit Sherlock is a little bit more on Enola's side than Mycroft is. Mycroft is sort of the bad guy brother, and Sherlock is kind of the good guy brother. But I saw them filming that scene together, and I'm like, yes, this absolutely, totally, just totally is going to work. They were perfect.
Oh, that's wonderful. So we're hoping for more Enola Holmes on the horizon. What else is keeping you busy, and where are the next forms of inspiration coming from, Nancy?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm now 72 years old. I kept writing in my 60s, but I could feel myself slowing down. And it got to the point where I would get up and start writing, and then after I finished writing, I had to go back to bed again to recover. So, and as I said, I gradually slowed down. I did fewer short stories. I did different kinds of novels. I did something called The Oddling Prince, and I did something totally different called Grand Ghost, which is about a woman who lives in the Florida Panhandle and discovers the skeleton of a child in her backyard. That was me, except for the skeleton, of course. He wasn't actually there.
But that's a relief.
Anyhow, long and short of it is, these days I do very little except just putter around online and keep the fan base going, keep the what they call the internet platform up. I'm happy to be financially secure and not to feel the pressure to write that I once did. A lot of that, the prolific writer thing, a lot of it had to do with my emotional needs, but a lot of it also had to do with financial need. And now that I'm married for a second time to a different man, I'm no longer having those yearning daydreams. So I don't have the emotional need to write that I used to.
Wow, that's quite a journey. You know, I mean, your own, personal and emotional needs, as you've said, your financial needs. It's really all come home for you now, and it's wonderful to hear.
It has. It's like a story in and of itself.
It's a
total 180.
Maybe that's your next story. Who knows? The good news is, I think you leave the emotional needs of your readers in the balance, and they are always yearning for more. So that's a wonderful feeling to have as a writer.
Thank you.
Nancy Springer, thank you so much for sharing your story and your stories with us. We're very much looking forward to where the arc of Enola Holmes is going next, and we encourage everyone to watch Enola Holmes spring to life on the screen on Netflix on September 23rd. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
What a pleasure to talk to, you know, we've talked to so many authors. I don't know that we've ever talked to a writer quite as diligent, professional, personally insightful, interesting as Nancy Springer. You know, and she mentions she mentions, you know, about the start of Enola Holmes, which was with an editor who said, you know, I'd really like you to do something in the age of Jack the Ripper. But before that, she said, you know, we were working on someone was working on this King Arthur book, and they asked if I would do a story. And I went out to walk the dog and came back and said, okay, I got a story. And that, and she said, that became I Am Mordred. You know, I took a quick look at her bibliography. I Am Mordred begins with King Arthur having fathered a child with his half-sister and placing all the newborn babies born on May 30th on a boat to drown, including his own son, Mordred.
Yeah.
Now that's a one-sentence summary by somebody who summarized it. But my God, I'd love to be able to walk the dog and come back with a story like that.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I have. I just haven't put it down on paper.
Well, you need more paper.
No, it's you're absolutely right, Burr. And to me, the thing that struck me about Nancy is her incredible self-awareness. I think when we think about authors, particularly those who are responsible for Sherlock Holmes-related stories, they know their subject really well. They know the time in which Sherlock Holmes lived. They know the details about Jack the Ripper. They know how the Victorian railway train tables worked, etc. Or perhaps they've studied the writing style of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle so that they're able to mimic it fairly well. I don't think I've come across a single writer who has been able to articulate their own self-awareness as their base of knowledge and strength for creating the character and the world in which that character inhabited, as well as Nancy did.
Well, you may remember Dan Andriacco, the time he joined us on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere on episode 141. The episode was called Baker Street Beat. If you haven't listened to that, go ahead and check it out. Dan is he's a retiree now. I'm not sure if he was retired when he talked to us, but he's been writing for a long time. And his passion, of course, is Sherlock Holmes. And he has a whole series of stories that feature Sebastian McCabe and Jeff Cody. And it began early on with No Police Like Holmes. And then it went into Holmes Sweet Holmes, The Disappearance of Mr. James Fillmore, and other titles. And Dan has a latest book available as a Kickstarter. And we'll have a link for you in the show notes. But it's a book of short stories called Murderer's Row. And it's specific to Sebastian McCabe and Jeff Cody. What do we know about this book or about this duo that is worthy of our comment, Bert?
Well, it's a great detective. It's a great collection of characters. Sebastian McCabe is a mystery writer. He's a magician. He's a Sherlockian. And he solves murders from the small town of Erin, Ohio, which is where he lives, all the way to London, where he walks in the footsteps of Sherlock Holmes. But his associate, his brother-in-law, is a sort of a Watsonian character, Thomas Jefferson Cody, who happens to be the communications director for a university. And it's at that university where Sebastian McCabe also teaches as a full professor. And there's a lovely cast of characters here, including Thomas Jefferson Cody's journalist wife, Linda. But these are really classic golden age mysteries set today. And Murderer's Row, will be a lot of fun. There's this Kickstarter you mentioned. I'm sure we'll get it off the ground. It's a set of novellas set around the holidays. So it's a destination wedding on the tropical island of Barbados. There's an annual Independence Day parade where a murder happens. It's the world of independent minor league baseball. And the lovely thing about it, because Dan shares our interest in bow ties. And in fact, he is the top knot of his last bow. And that's how one of our deeper connections to Dan. But the lovely part of this is when you're reading something and you know the author is referring to something Sherlockian, because you'll find a quote. Well, Dan, obviously, as a Sherlockian, has peppered these stories with lovely references to Sherlock Holmes. And part of the fun of reading them is discovering them. So it's really a lot of fun.
It is. And go and have yourself some fun at Kickstarter. We'll have a link in the show notes, or just go directly to danandriacco.com and poke around there. You'll have a grand time.
Well, that music means that it is time, of course, for everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz show. That's right, it's Canonical Couplets, where we give you two lines of poetry, and you need to identify the Sherlock Holmes story that it represents. If you were around here on episode 199, you heard this clue. A post from Pondicherry and another from Dundee took a client's life by villains dead upon the sea. Bert, do you know which story that referred to?
Yes, that is the story about the evil contractor who never showed up. That's the story they called The No Good Builder.
I'll tell you, there's something no good about this right now. Yeah, that's it's not even close. It's the Five Orange Pips.
Oh, wrong again.
Yeah. Although I will say we had another helpful hint from our friend Eric Deckers, who said it was Gladys Openshaw and the Orange Pips. Well, let's see who our lucky winner is this time around and give the big prize wheel a spin as it goes around there. Lots of numbers to choose from, lots of entries this time. And it lands on number 37. 37, and that corresponds to Bob Hanmer. Bob, congratulations. You are the lucky winner of an MX book of Sherlock Holmes stories. We'll be getting that out to you post-haste. And now we will give you a chance to win a prize. This time the prize around is a copy of Nancy Springer's first Enola Holmes book, The Case of the Missing Marquess. And here's the clue. An ugly, long hair fond of creosote led to the Thames and a steam-powered boat. If you know the answer to this week's canonical couplet, jot it down in an email addressed to comment@ihearofsherlock.com with canonical couplet in the subject line. If you are among the correct answers and we choose your name at random, you'll win. Good luck. All right. I'm surprised we continue to make it through that process every week or every episode.
Yes, well, just shows you what diligence will do.
Something like that. Well, I would be remiss to if I did not mention that you have an opportunity to get your hands on some Sherlockian merchandise, some Sherlockian wearable merchandise. You know, we're living in the age of COVID. And people are all masked up all around the world, really. Well, you have an opportunity to get a Sherlockian mask. It is the Afoot design from our friends at Bow Ties Limited of Vermont. You remember that we had Cy Tall here on the show earlier in 2020 to talk about bow ties. We talked with her on episode 184, Tying One On with Sherlock Holmes. And during the pandemic, Bow Ties Limited has pivoted and now offer not only bow ties and neckties, but also masks. And the Afoot comes from one of their bow tie patterns with little dog paw prints on it. And it, of course, is inspired by Sherlock Holmes and the games afoot. So highly appropriate that IHO's listeners have a chance to get an Afoot mask. Bert, have you gotten any fashion-forward masks yet?
No, well, a couple. My wife has actually been sewing masks for a charity. There's a charitable operation that does that. And she has a very nice design, but I don't have anything remotely as fashionable as what the bow tie, what our pals at Bow Ties do.
Well, we'll have to correct that pretty soon then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much done as much damage here as we possibly can. Until the next time around, I am the constantly masked Scott Monty.
And I am the perpetually muted Bert Wolder.
And together, with masks on, we say...
The game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.